Actually, there's a typo. That's not what I'm going to talk about at all.
Okay.
Before we consider the current condition of law in the international realm, it may be fruitful to survey briefly what it has historically been. The idea and the actuality of international law are extremely old, dating in the Eastern Mediterranean, for instance, from a millennium or so BC. It was concerned with such matters as the sanctity of ambassadors, asylum, extradition, the sufficient causes of war, limitations upon the conduct of war, truces, the taking of prisoners, hostages, spies, maritime trade and warfare, and treaties. Enforcement of the law depended in considerable measure upon the gods, and though that may seem a slender reed to skeptical moderns, it was a powerful restraining force among the ancients. But the main roots of international law, as we know it, are to be found in Rome, where it grew along two distinct lines. One was what the Romans call jus gentium, usually but not quite accurately translated as the law of nations. As Rome grew and had increasing contact with other peoples, it became necessary to reconcile differences between Rome's 12 tables and the laws governing others. And over the years, the officials appointed for the purpose, who were called praetores peregrinus, learned that many laws and customs were common to all or to nearly all nations, and they systematically codified these. The other strain was natural law, an idea that the Romans derived from various Greeks, notably the Stoics. Natural law concepts, propagated most influentially among the Rome in Rome by Cicero, held that rules of behavior, of what is right and what is wrong, are implanted by the gods in the heart of every man and are discoverable by right reason. Romans often distinguished between jus gentium and jus naturae as if they were different, but the content of the two was approximately the same. A large part of the law of nations, then as now, pertained to warfare. The jus ad bellum, law in war, was concerned with the justice of a war and the necessity for a declaration of war before engaging in hostilities. There was an exception made with regard to brigands and pirates who were outside the protection of both the civil law and the law of nations. The Romans had elaborate rituals for determining whether a war was just. The only acceptable reason for a war, a just war, was to rectify wrongs. And the goal of war, in Cicero's formulation, was that, quote, we may live in peace. The jus in bello, the other half of it, which means the laws in war, or the laws specifying the rules governing the actual conduct of war. These included the exemption of non-combatants from harm, the sanctity of ambassadors and sacred places, the outlawing of the use of poison, and the granting of mercy to the vanquished, except when they had behaved in particularly barbarous fashion. Another exception was siege warfare, in which no one was immune from brutal destruction. Rome collapsed, of course, and barbarian hordes marauded Europe for some centuries. But though the concept of natural law disappeared, or all but disappeared, for a time, the idea and practice of the law of nations survived, albeit sometimes in a rather feeble form. By and large, and here I'm speaking of the medieval period, though the generalization I'm about to make applies to modern times as well, by and large, I say, international law has been recognized and observed in proportion as one or more of three general conditions have obtained. The most obvious circumstance is when one nation is powerful enough to be able to impose its will upon all its neighbors, as Imperial Rome had been when at its greatest height, greatest strength. Efforts to reconstitute the imperial authority during the Middle Ages, that is the crowning of Charlemagne as emperor on Christmas Day 800 and the crowning of Otto I as Holy Roman Emperor in 972, these efforts were far from universal successes. The closest any Holy Roman Emperor came to establishing hegemony was the Emperor Charles V during the 16th century. And Charles dissipated the fortune that he obtained from America in his capacity as King of Spain, or properly Castile, in futile effort, he dissipated this fortune in futile efforts to suppress the Protestant Reformation. After Charles, rulers gave up trying to master the continent, Napoleon being the conspicuous exception, until Hitler's time, settling instead for attempting to strike a balance of power. Another ameliorating possibility is the presence of a moral authority sufficiently influential as to require states to behave in an honorable, orderly, and humane fashion. In Western history, the one such authority has been the Roman Catholic Church, or more properly, the papacy. The practical influence of the church waxed and waned during medieval times, but even during the worst periods of feudal warfare, it was often able to bring some order out of chaos and to limit the slaughter. Moreover, for a quarter of a millennium in the so-called High Middle Ages, that is from the middle of the 11th century to the end of the 13th, its moral authority genuinely imposed a regime of Christian international law in Europe. Part of the reason for its success, it must be admitted, was that Christians were encouraged to vent their aggressiveness on crusades against the infidels. The third condition in which law and order prevails internationally occurs when heads of states or individuals of different nationalities perceive it to be in their mutual interest to act honorably, fairly, and lawfully, even toward rivals or enemies. The chivalric code is an example. Knights fought according to extremely strict rules, and they never violated them, or almost never. Another example is the so-called lex mercatoria, or law merchants, that is, the body of rules respecting contracts, negotiable instruments, insurance, and the like, which evolved from the 11th century onward and governed the relations of international merchants. It is important to note that both the chivalric code and the lex mercatoria, though based mainly on self-interest and upon honor, were enforceable in special courts that were established in every kingdom in Europe. Now let us seg into the modern world, or toward it anyway. The medieval order in Europe broke down between the mid-14th and mid-17th century, and a new order emerged. One major step was the Hundred Years' War, which is conventionally dated from 1337 to 1453, which brought the demise of feudalism and chivalry and saw the rise of the nation-state having standing armies and full powers of taxation. If you want to look for the good old days, crowned heads of Europe actually did not have the power to collect taxes until this period. In the wake of that came the discoveries of the New World, raising different questions about the jus gentium, and then the Protestant Reformation, which led to a century and a half of intermittent religious warfare, culminating in the horrors of the 30 Years' War, which is conventionally dated from 1618 to 1648. But this same period saw the development of permanent embassies and, what was quite as important, the work of the great pioneer theorists in the field of international law. These included, most influentially, the Spanish theologians Francisco Vitoria and Francisco Suarez, the Italo-English jurist Alberico Gentili, and the Dutch jurist Hugo Grotius. Drawing upon divine law as revealed in scripture, upon Roman law as codified by Justinian and glossed by medieval scholars, the canon law as adapted by the Decretalist, the works of Augustine and Aquinas, and the full range of history then known, these men demonstrated that international law did exist, that it was morally binding, and that it were prudent to obey it. Because the crowned heads of Europe were judicious enough to recognize the wisdom of what these theorists taught, and powerful enough to put the teachings into practice, the period from the beginning of the active rule of Louis XIV to the execution of Louis XVI, which is roughly 1661 to 1793, this period was the golden age of international law. Having proclaimed that, I hasten to elaborate and qualify. First, theorizing about international law did not stop with Grotius. A host of subsequent writers, including the great Emmerich de Vattel, rounded out the subject. Secondly, Louis XIV and the many sovereigns who emulated him were driven by a desire for territorial and pecuniary aggrandizement, but were equally motivated by a craving for immortal fame, a quest that would have been jeopardized by behaving dishonorably in conducting relations with other rulers. Thirdly, the shift in the object of statecraft to naked pursuit of power and profit made compromise possible, as it had not been during the religious wars when immortal souls were at stake, and therefore made international relations far more civilized. Indeed, warfare during the late 17th and most of the 18th century became a polite gentleman's game, as stylized and ritualized and graceful as a minuet. And yet, the civilizing process did not extend to relations with people apart from Christendom, such as Indians in the Americas and Asia, who remained beyond the pale of what Westerners regarded as civilization and were treated accordingly. The Golden Age came to an end during, and in no small measure because of, the French Revolution. The whole idea that the law of nature underlay the law of nations was discredited by the revolutionaries' use of natural law and the deification of reason to justify aberrational conduct. And the ruthless, massive, and efficient French armies ran roughshod over all opponents for a full generation until the latter learned how to fight as the French fought. Two, Napoleon regarded treaties among sovereigns, and indeed the very concept of sovereignty, with utter and total contempt. The experience disenchanted European statesmen and prompted them to take a different approach to international relations in future. This approach, put into execution at the Congress of Vienna in 1815, was to lodge the settlement of interstate problems in a European concert, as it was called, consisting of Prussia, Russia, Britain, and Austria. France was added a few years later. That arrangement, the European concert, coupled with a shift to positive international law in the form of treaties and multilateral pacts, such as the Hague and Geneva Conventions, actually worked in practice, and Europe was without a major war for almost exactly a century, from 1815 to 1914. The 20th century elaborations of the European concert, that is to say, the League of Nations and the United Nations, were not successful. The League never had a chance, not, as I was taught as a child, because the United States to join it, but because the war that gave it birth destroyed the world economy and led inexorably to World War II. The United Nations never had a chance either, for it was absorbed from the beginning into the larger conflict we call the Cold War. As for the old version of jus in bello, the actual laws of actual conduct of war, during the century of peace, that law had been replaced by various multilateral conventions, which were, for the most part, observed during World War I, though the use of new weapons technology, not provided for by the conventions, did introduce new horrors. The Second World War, in these respects, was a mixed bag. The massive slaughter of civilians by Germany and the Soviet Union violated all canons of humanity and warfare, as did the Japanese treatment of Allied prisoners. But the wholesale destruction of civilians in England by the Luftwaffe and the subsequent destruction in Germany and Japan by the Allied air forces, while horrific, was no more inhumane than sieges of cities had been for time immemorial. As for Vietnam, that was not a war, as war had long been defined by Western civilization, for the Vietnamese did not fight in accordance with Western rules, the result being brutalization on both sides. Our major failing in Vietnam was that we were not willing, couldn't bring ourselves to be willing, to be brutal enough to win. But now that is all behind us and the new world order has come, or so we are told. I would contend, on the contrary, that we are drifting back toward world chaos. Let us consider the matter in the light of the three necessary conditions for international lawfulness that I mentioned earlier. One, you'll remember, was that for the statesmen of every nation of consequence to perceive that it is in their interest to comport themselves honorably, fairly, and lawfully. Now, most of the nations of Europe, of North America, and the Pacific Rim seem to understand that proposition, but what does one do about the former Yugoslavia, Iran, Iraq, the terrorists who stalk much of the rest of the Islamic world, North Korea, Communist China, and Sub-Saharan Africa? Moreover, though the good guy countries are committed to cooperation in, for example, such matters as removing barriers to international trade, it is not difficult to imagine, in the event of a major worldwide economic downturn, that heads of state would scurry to protect what they narrowly define as their interest at the expense of others. Again, though the world has produced no new Rome, it can be argued that the United States, in combination with its allies, has so great a preponderance of military power as to be able to exert its will against outlaw nations anywhere on the planet. It can be so argued, I say. And in the euphoric glow after the Gulf War, many people may have believed it. But in light of what has happened since, in Somalia, in Liberia, in Haiti, in Rwanda, and so elsewhere, to believe it requires a large capacity for refusing to see the obvious. And finally, there's the matter of moral authority. Certainly no current religious institution can match the influence of the 13th century papacy. But advocates of the New World Order consider that as progress. They contend that modern enlightened consciousness has evolved an efficacious substitute for the laws of nature's God in the form of commitment to universal human rights. Indeed, they consider human rights doctrine to be more efficacious than natural law precisely because superstitious faith has been eliminated from the equation. But let us consider the words moral and authority. Moral derives from the Latin for custom, authority from the Latin for author or creator. The one corresponds with the ancient jus gentium, the other with the jus naturae. To speak of moral authority without God is an oxymoron, for both morality and authority come from the author of us all. Thank you.